Rodrigo's Lacey. That should be interesting. VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the podcast, we learn from Gregory Stockel about why Taiwan is able to manage extremely strong earthquakes like the one on April 3rd. For one, the country has very strict building requirements. Then, Andrew Smith joins us to talk about why reindeer herders in Norway now have to feed their animals. Following Andrew, Katie and I bring you the Higher Education Report. Afterward, Anna Mateo joins us for this week's Words and Their Stories, and it is the true, authentic, and not fake Anna Mateo. Now, here's Gregory.
On April 3rd, Taiwan was hit by its most powerful earthquake in 25 years. The earthquake killed at least 12 people and injured more than 1,000. The earthquake damaged buildings and roadways, and workers at quarries had no way home. Taiwan sees powerful earthquakes from time to time. Experts say the damage to the East Asian island and its 23 million people has been contained thanks to its earthquake preparedness. Here are details of Taiwan's history of earthquakes. Taiwan lies along what is known as the Pacific Ring of Fire. It is the line of faults around the Pacific Ocean where most of the world's earthquakes happen. The Earth's outer covering is divided into large pieces on which the oceans and land masses sit. These pieces are called tectonic plates, and where they meet is called a fault line. Earthquakes are common in the area near Taiwan because pressure builds up where the Philippine Sea Plate and the Eurasian Plate meet. The built-up pressure releases suddenly in the form of earthquakes. The area's mountains can increase ground movement, leading to landslides. Several landslides happened on Taiwan's eastern coast, near the center of the recent quake, near eastern Huanlian County. Falling rock hit roadways, crushed vehicles, and caused several deaths. Taiwan's earthquake agency measured the recent earthquake at 7.2 magnitude. The U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS, estimated it at 7.4. The quake damaged several buildings in Hualien, but caused minor losses in the capital, Taipei, although it was strongly felt there. The earthquake hit in the morning when people were on their way to work. But just minutes later, parents were again walking their children to school, and workers were driving to offices. Stephen Gao is an earthquake expert and professor at Missouri University of Science and Technology. He said, "Taiwan's earthquake preparedness is among the most advanced in the world." He said the country has strong building laws, a good earthquake network, and widespread public education campaigns and earthquake safety. The government regularly increases the level of quake resistance required of new and existing buildings. This increases the costs of a building, but the government offers financial support to people willing to have their buildings examined for quake resistance. There has also been punishment for failing to meet requirements. Following a 2016 quake in the southwestern city of Tainan, 5 people were found guilty of negligence and given prison sentences. The people were involved in building a tall apartment building, but it was the only major structure to collapse in that quake. Taiwan also is pushing quake exercises at schools and workplaces. Media regularly carry warnings about earthquakes and safety that go out to cell phones. Gao said those measures have helped Taiwan deal with earthquakes and prevent loss of life and damage. Taiwan and its surrounding waters have registered about 2,000 earthquakes that measured 4.0 or greater since 1980. And it measured more than 100 earthquakes above 5.5, the USGS found. The island's most serious quake in recent memory hit on September 21, 1999. The 7.7 magnitude quake caused 2,400 deaths, injured 100,000, and destroyed thousands of buildings. Daniel Aldrich teaches political science and public policy at Northwestern University. He said it was a major wake-up call that led to important government changes to improve emergency services and disaster reduction. As a result, the government passed the Disaster Prevention and Protection Act. Taiwan set up 2 national centers to deal with earthquakes. Aldrich said, "I think we're seeing the results in this most recent shock." I'm Gregory Stockel.
As he drives slowly across snow, Nils Mathis Sara drops food on the ground for hundreds of his reindeer to eat. His animals live in Finnmark, the northernmost point of Norway. But Sara wishes he did not have to feed them. "This is an emergency situation," said the 65-year-old Sara. "I am not supposed to feed them. They are supposed to feed me." Sara is Sami, an ethnic group native to the northern areas of Norway, Sweden, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. Normally, the reindeer find their own food. They dig through the snow to reach small plants, called lichen, buried below. But every winter for the past 10 years, Sara has had to buy food to help the animals live through the cold season. Winter temperatures in the area can drop to as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius. Until recently, only snow fell during the winter months in Finnmark. But in recent years, the weather has been warmer, with temperatures sometimes rising above freezing. That means rain, instead of snow, falls on the ground. Then, when the temperature drops, that water turns to ice. The thick ice makes it difficult for the reindeer to reach the lichen. It is especially hard for the younger reindeer, as their hooves are not strong enough to break through, Sara said. One morning in March, Sara and a family member put down about 1.5 metric tons of food for the reindeer. The two men have been doing the same thing every other day since February. I should really be doing this every day, but economically it does not make sense, said Sara. Feeding the animals can also bring unexpected results. Later that day, Sara sees hundreds of reindeer in his reindeer feeding area. But the reindeer do not belong to him. Sara quickly drives over to the herder of the other reindeer. He asks the herder to move the animals out of the area. The reindeer had come to Sara's area because of the smell of the food Sara had put on the ground. In addition, reindeer are semi-wild. Normally, herders follow the animals as they look for food under the snow. But feeding the animals makes them slowly become less wild and depend more on humans. This makes the Sami people live more like farmers than herders. Sara says this goes against the Sami's traditional way of living. When we feed the reindeer, they change their behavior and become more accustomed to humans, Sara said. This is not our way. I'm Andrew Smith.
Students like Jeannie Tarnu of Annandale, Virginia, have a chance to say a lot about themselves on their college applications. They can tell about classroom success that came from long hours of doing homework. They can write about time they spent after school as leaders of student activity groups. But a decision last year by the U.S. Supreme Court means they will have only one chance to talk about their family background or nationalities. That chance comes in the part of the application that calls for a piece of writing about a single subject, known as an essay. In the past, students like Tarnu would have been able to tell colleges about their backgrounds in another part of the application. Then they could discuss something else in their essay. Now colleges cannot ask about race. Tarnu is a first-generation American. She was born in the United States, but her parents came to the U.S. from the African nation of Liberia about 20 years ago. Tarnu will start college later this year. She started working on her applications around this time in 2023. She thought carefully about the questions that came as part of the common application. The application is a standard form that students can use to apply to over 1,000 colleges and universities. The application offers 7 essay prompts or suggestions. One question asks students to tell a meaningful story about themselves. Another asks for a story about overcoming obstacles. An obstacle is another word for a barrier. Tarnu said she could have written about what it was like to be the child of immigrants for her essay. Instead, she wrote about overcoming a challenge. She said she had a speech delay as a girl, and found herself in a special education program called IEP. I was placed at the age of 3, Tarnu said. I talked about my process of leaving that program because that program is really hard to get out of.
I also added a metaphor of me being a butterfly and coming out of a cocoon.
Tarnu said she used a short answer part of the application to discuss her family's background in Liberia. She wrote about learning a special Liberian handshake that is connected to the time when those who formed Liberia were enslaved in the United States. She said she chose not to write about her race in the personal statement because everyone writes about it, and you have to stand out above the other applicants. A number of students around the U.S. seem to have the same idea. The Associated Press spoke with students in Chicago, Illinois, Cleveland, Ohio, Portland, Oregon, and Boston, Massachusetts, about how they decided to write their college essays. In Chicago, Hilary Amofa said she started trauma dumping when she wrote a first version of her essay. She wrote about being the daughter of immigrants from Ghana. But she worried that the essay did not talk about who she was as a person. She wondered if she had to go through something horrible to feel worthy of going to a school. Later, she wrote about being at ease wearing her hair in a natural style, although her white classmates criticized her about it when she was a girl. Now, she said, she has a small business styling hair for Black women. In her essay, she wrote, "Criticism will persist, but it loses power when you know there's a crown on your head." After the Supreme Court's decision, some universities expanded their prompts. Brown University in Rhode Island and Rice University in Houston, Texas, included questions that ask about a student's challenges growing up or how their opinions were shaped by their backgrounds or race. Darian Merritt of Cleveland wondered if schools like Yale, Stanford, or Vanderbilt wanted a sob story. He said he wrestled with the question of whether he went through hard enough times as a child to deserve having a spot at the university. Merritt chose to write about an experience at summer camp when he started to feel more at ease or comfortable. He wrote about wondering whether he was Black enough and discussed being made fun of for listening to white people music. He also wrote about taking ownership of myself and my future by sharing my true personality. Merritt said he felt comfortable sending an honest story to colleges.
In Portland, Max Decker started working on his college essays before the Supreme Court's decision last year. At first, he had written about his love of video games, but the essay he sent to colleges was very different. He wrote about a nonprofit community group called Word is Bond. The group works with young Black men. Decker is of mixed race. He said he always felt like the odd one out before he became a part of the group and found acceptance. On a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet with lawmakers, he realized he offered something special to the world because he is different. Decker said he felt comfortable writing about his race in an essay if it could help him get into a better college. He noticed that his high school friends, who had college graduate parents, were in a better position. They knew it was important to get into higher level classes at the start of high school, for example. In the end, Decker said both essays were true, but the one he submitted to colleges felt more like the truth the world was expecting of him. Imani Laird of Boston said she felt as if she had to fully explain the way her race affected her life. "I didn't have it easier because of my race," she said. "I had stuff I had to overcome." So she wrote about her grandfather. She said he was not permitted to enter a special program for former soldiers to go to college because he was black. She said facing racism makes her want to do great things with her life or to excel. "My goal in class was not just to participate, but to excel. Beyond academics, I wanted to excel while remembering what started this motivation in the first place." The group of students who are finishing high school this year are the first class to submit applications under the new policy. What advice do they have for future students? Tarnu said students should still write about moments that really shaped your character and personality and experiences that led to personal growth. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. You can trust that we are actually Voice of America Learning English. We are the real deal. We are authentic. In other words, we are not bogus. Bogus is an adjective that means fake or phony. Something bogus is not genuine. It is a fraud. It's fraudulent. For example, the man's huge diamond ring was bogus. He told everyone it was a real diamond, but actually, it was just a piece of glass. Bogus can describe something that is a lie. If something like an explanation or reason is bogus, it's not true. For example, an employee might call her employer to say she needs a sick day off from work. But during the call, her boss hears loud, live music in the background. The employee was clearly at a music show. Her reason for not being at work was bogus. We could also say the employee's excuse did not hold water. Her excuse for missing work sounded bogus. It was not believable. It didn't hold water. Experts at the online dictionary Merriam-Webster explain that bogus began as a noun. In the early 19th century in the U.S., a bogus was a machine that made counterfeit or fake money. Here's a fun fact. You can call bogus counterfeit money funny money. Here is another word related to bogus: sham. Sham, a noun, describes a fake, made-up situation. We use shams to cover up the truth. Let's hear some of these terms used in a short story. Two roommates work together at a bank. One day they decide to steal all the gold and jewelry held in the bank's safe. So they plot. They plan it out. First, they need an alibi. Where can they be while the robbery is actually happening? They create a bogus alibi. They tell police that at the time of the robbery, they were together at a volunteer event, cleaning up a local park by the town's river. But after checking out their alibi, police brought the two in for questioning. Then detectives searched their shared apartment and found all the gold and jewels from the bank robbery. What made the police suspect them? Can you guess what detectives found at the river park that proved their alibi was a sham? A dirty park and river. They both had a huge amount of trash. Clearly, no cleanup event had ever taken place. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Podcast. And this is the real Learning English Podcast, right, Anna?
Yes, it is, Dan. This is the real podcast. No counterfeit voices here. This is the real Anna Mateo.
That's right. All those bogus, fake, and phony voices and podcasts can go take a hike.
Or they can go jump in a river. A dirty river that needs a cleanup.
That's right. The river in your story, I'm sure, still has yet to be cleaned up.
Thank you for referencing the story, Dan. But let's slow down a bit for a second here. You just got right into the conversation without much of an introduction.
That is true. But your story this week got me a little fired up. I like authentic things and I don't like fraud. But yes, let me remind our listeners, we're talking about the word bogus with Anna Mateo today.
Yep, Dan, that's right. Something that is bogus is not true.
Anna, I liked the story you told this week that while we use the word bogus today as an adjective, it really is connected to a noun. So can you remind everyone about where the word bogus comes from?
Sure. Bogus was the name of a machine that made fake or counterfeit money about 200 years ago.
And I didn't know anything about this. You could call it funny money, right?
You can call it funny money, and that's fun to say. Is that your dog in the background, Dan?
Yeah, she. There's nothing bogus about her either. She makes a lot of noise.
She is a real dog.
She is a real dog with real squeaky sounds. You can call something a sham or made up. You can say a story doesn't hold water.
That's right, Dan. We have many ways of talking about inauthentic, non-genuine, fake things. Bogus is one of them. And you said one just now, which is one of my favorites, a sham.
Anna, I think one of the interesting things that we should remind our listeners about is the idea that language changes over time. Who knew that the word bogus, which referred to a real counterfeit money-making machine, was going to change over time from a noun to an adjective? But that's how it goes sometimes.
That's how language works.
Anna, thanks for talking with us today about this interesting, authentic, true story.
You're welcome, Dan. Thanks for inviting me to your podcast. You're the real deal.
Thanks. And that's the Learning English Podcast for today. Thanks again, Anna. and thanks to all my VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.